Well, you know, I think that we, especially it seems like now more than ever, we live in this age of divisive politics. And that division sows a lot of discontent and doesn't seem to be working as far as implementing good policy and getting things done. And, you know, my background and Bill's background, we like to tackle problems. We like to look for solutions. We actually want to find common ground with individuals. And it's really hard to do that when you get entrenched in your party platform in you know, sort of these are the confines of how you have to act and behave, and, you know, and good luck. And politics doesn't work that way, and it certainly doesn't work that way in Alaska. I mean, you have lots of examples over the years of individuals working across party lines and ignoring party boundaries to try to find solutions that work for Alaska. And, you know, when Governor Walker served, our administration had Republicans and Democrats and independents and, you know, nonpartisans. And we had this common goal of doing what's best for Alaska and having a passion for the state. And it worked. It worked really well. And did we agree all the time? No. But did we find solutions? We did. And I think that we came up with better solutions and implemented better policy because we had those different viewpoints that we took into account.
Let me just add briefly to that. You know, one of my highlights and memories of being governor was the inaugural ball we had here in Ketchikan. And one of my favorite posters, we kept it. I don't know who did it. It was a poster that said, you can find unity in community. And I just thought that was really good because I come from a local government background and I really believe that. So we're not razor sharp politicians. We're two Alaskan born raised folks that love Alaska more than our frustration with the divisiveness in politics and whatnot. So, but I'll never forget that you can find unity in community, and that was here in Ketchikan.
So obviously, you know, ferry service is a big issue here. And Bill, you talked about this a little bit the last time we were here. One of your suggestions was open the bars, and they have opened the bars on some of the ferries. And I'm curious what else you guys believe should be done to make sure we have a strong, reliable marine highway system that provides predictable service for Southeast communities.
Well, the operative word you mentioned is predictable service, a schedule that means something, that really means something. I think the IFA has a much better schedule, reliable schedule, than the Marine Highway System does. You know, I think that the run to Prince Rupert needs to be more regular, more frequent. You know, I certainly talked about opening the bars, and I used to be in the bar business. It put me through law school. It was a very small bar. It was not on a boat and had to compete with other bars. But beyond that, I mean, I think we need to recognize the marine highway system for what it is. I mean, it goes through the very same waters that all these big cruise ships go through. Not everybody is, you know, and that's great. We love the cruise ships, don't get me wrong, but not everybody wants to be on a cruise ship. And so I think to have a Ureo pass for the marine highway system, do you hop on, hop off? You come into Ketchikan, it's a beautiful day, and say, hey, we want to stay here a couple of days. You hop off, go to a B&B for a couple of days, jump back on again. I think we need to have music. I'd love to see music on the marine highway system. I mean, local entertainment, local groups that I've tested that in Juneau at the folk festival and said how many would want to do that. I think all hands went up, and so that would be pretty phenomenal. We need to have the naturalists back on it as well. So I just think that we are we're not reaching the potential, the maximum opportunities that we can have on the marine highway system. I actually think, I'm going to get myself in trouble, like I'll show you, I'm not a very good politician, but I honestly think that there should be an Alaskan discount for Alaska residents. You know, you have that in Hawaii. You go to various places in Hawaii, and they say, are you a resident of Hawaii? And no. And so you pay a little bit more, and the residents pay a little bit less. I think because that's a highway system for us, it's different than let's take the family on a vacation. Let's take the family to a medical appointment. Or let's take the family to, you know, it's a necessary piece of it. So it becomes a toll road to those that use it. So I think there should be a discount for Alaskan residents. I really do. I just think that it's just such a critical part of the economic fabric of coastal Alaska.
So you see marketing it to outsiders and sort of as a vehicle for tourism rather than
absolutely a vehicle for tourism but you have to start that with, quite honestly, more frequency on that Prince Rupert run, because that's the feeder into the system. And if that's coming on once a month, there ought to be at least one if not two trips a week out of Prince Rupert, so they can go from Cincinnati, drive to Prince Rupert, and then get into the system. And then once we're in the system, they can go from there. So it's just we know there's plenty of room for improvement. We just need to make that a priority.
So another one of the big issues here in Ketchikan, especially, but also throughout Alaska, is affordable housing. Here in Ketchikan, it's tough to find a place to live. It's very expensive to build here, right? I'm wondering what solutions you guys might have for increasing the supply of affordable housing in Ketchikan and elsewhere in Alaska.
We know there's a couple of things. My background is a carpenter. My background is building, and my father had a construction company, very small, because it's just my brother and myself mostly, building houses and trying to bring affordable housing. This was many years ago. So without affordable housing, you can't get employees. Without affordable quality childcare, you can't get employees. So that's the building blocks of a healthy economy. So there's a couple of things that can be done. One is, if the state has any land at all that can be used for, creating subdivisions, it needs to be made available to local communities, transferred over the communities, somehow turned into private sector hands for that, but not necessarily for, building, $500,000 homes or $1 million homes. That's the wrong end of the spectrum. So we've met with, almost every community we've been to many, and Nome was certainly very vivid discussion about that. Homer, everywhere we went, there's no place we haven't gone that doesn't come up, that they all have the same challenge. Some have issues with, utilities being extended. We need to have, Kodiak had a question about an issue about, expansion of their utilities. So the bipartisan infrastructure money that's going to be available in the next couple of years is available for competitive grants for states to compete for. We think there's an opportunity with using some of those funds for, and that's $100 to $300 billion. It's not an insignificant pool of money. Every state will compete for that. Hopefully we will. I'm not sure with this administration we will, but certainly under our administration we will be very aggressive on that. Some of those funds, if they can be used to create a subdivision, bring down the cost of the subdivision, there are ways that I'd like to see. So if you take that piece of it out as a grant, that's going to bring down the cost of housing. And you can put some limitations on land as far as when you sell. We had this in Valdez after the earthquake when we moved to our new town. There were certain requirements, building requirements, that we had to build. We couldn't sit on the land and speculate. If you didn't build within the next number of months, the land would revert back to the city, whatnot. So it was part of the urban renewal piece of it. So the key is to make sure whatever land utilities are available, that it results in affordable housing.
Another issue that I think is on some folks' minds is out-migration. We've had these demographic trends for years with folks leaving Alaska, not moving here to raise families and such. I'm curious what your administration would do to address the demographic issues without migration?
It starts with affordable housing. It starts with child care. If you don't have, if you can't get child care for your young ones and you have a place to live, you're going to move. The brain drain out of Alaska. I was in a presentation yesterday, day before, 20,000 young people have left Alaska. It's not a matter of people not showing up and don't want to work. They've left. They've gone because they didn't think they could find what they needed here. One person has gone all the way as far as Ames, Iowa, before they found a place where they could buy a home. Where they could, he and his wife could buy a home, and I think he still commutes back and forth here, but he had to go that far before he found affordable housing. We've got to get a handle on that, because otherwise we will continue to have the brain drain. Our university enrollment is down. There's so many changes in the state that I don't fault anybody that's leaving. I just hate to hear the stories. And I was in Soldotna a couple of days ago at a farmer's market, and one young you know, person there was telling me she just graduated from college and she took a teaching job in New York. She said it was a much better deal than what she get in Alaska. She says she was born here, she's third generation, she loves Alaska, but she just can't take the job here because no benefits, no housing, no this, no that. So
it's really, I think that's something that we're struggling with the most, is seeing the Alaska that we know and love and the one that I grew up in, is it feels like it's slipping away unless we change, unless we have a course correction. You see the ripple effects of the decisions that are made. You know, this current administration, this governor he proposed to cut education by 25%. He proposed to cut the university system by 40%. He proposed to hack away at the Marine Highway System budget, 67%. Not all of those cuts were sustained because the legislature put its foot down, but there were significant cuts made. It spurred a recall effort. And you see the ripple effects. The university's budget was cut significantly. We lost professors. We lost, tenured professors. We lost students because when you have difficulties with recruitment, you can't recruit students, or you can't fill programs because those professors have left. It's this cycle that happens where if you don't feel confident in your university system, why would you want to go there as a student? Why would you want to go there as a teacher? So we've heard, we visited UAA recently, and they're having a difficult time recruiting staff because, you know, what does it say about a state when it one of the first things it does is tries to cut the university system? Same with education. We've been cutting education or not fully funding education, and we see it in increased class sizes, and now we see it with school closures and some challenges. We're more than 1,000 teachers short in Alaska for this next school year. I don't know what some school districts are going to do.
The final topic I want to cover today is fisheries. We've seen king salmon stocks here in Ketchikan really take a big hit. We've got stocks of concern on the Unic and the Chickaman River. And elsewhere in Southeast, king salmon stocks of concern, big drops in returns there. And of course, that's not to even mention the Chum and Chinook crash in Western Alaska. And I'm curious what your administration might do to address those issues.
Well, I think one of the first things we would do is make sure that we have, a fully staffed Department of Fish and Game, make sure that we have a commissioner and heads of divisions that have subject matter expertise in their divisions. We've heard from across the state the need to fully fund the Department of Fish and Game so that we can, we have the research, the data that shows us why are these king salmon stocks declining.
You know, we were in Kodiak a while back for Crab Fest, and on the flight in, I was sitting next to a woman that I asked her what she did, and she said, "Well, I'm unemployed right now." I said, "What did you used to do?" She said, "I have to be a marine biologist for Department of Fish and Game." And she said, "You know, all that's been cut, largely cut, as far as on the research," and Heidi's absolutely correct about that. We need to find out what's happening. You need to find out why these runs aren't showing up. And that doesn't happen other than research and also local knowledge. I think sometimes we step over. You know, we were in Bethel a week or so ago and met with a board. And, you know, a gentleman on there said he's been hunting and fishing in that area for well over 50 years. And he feels he's earned a degree or two in understanding that because that's what he's done for subsistence and whatnot. So I don't think we listen to the local knowledge enough because that's the real boots on the ground experience and whatnot. So I think there's more we can do in that regard, but it really starts with, as Heidi said, fully funding the department, make sure we have the right people in the right positions, and that we get back to the science.
All right. Well, Bill Walker, Heidi Dragas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.